The father waited for some time. Then, moving very softly, he lit the candle at the kitchen fire, put it where it shouldn't light the boy's face, and watched him. And the child knew he was watching him, and pretended to sleep. And so pretending, he slept. The father was up at about 4 o'clock. He worked at his trade in a farming town about 5 miles away, and was struggling to make a farm and a home between jobs. He cooked bacon for breakfast, washed up the dishes and tidied the kitchen, gave the boys some bread and bacon fat, and told the eldest to take a cup of tea to his mother and bread and milk to the baby when they woke. And the year died, as many old years had died. Henry Lawson. A Child in the Dark and a Foreign Father. December 1902. The Bulletin.
1967, Kate was born.
I became a father in 1972. We had another child born in 1974.
We all married in 1979, with three children coming along in 81, 82 and 86.
First child was born in 1989.
We have a 15-year-old who was born in 1996.
I was a bachelor. Due to circumstance, I got married, which was a disaster.
I was asked by a lesbian couple in terms of having children, both of them. I was a little bit chuffed at being asked. They were quite particular about who they picked in terms of being the father anyway. It hasn't meant much at all, other than the fact that they call me Dad.
But I was born in 1923. I was Daddy's little boy. He used to go up and help the butcher do the slaughter and things, you see. I always went with him because I always used to want to bring me what I call pig's liver. I used to bring that home.
When Dad killed the sheep, which was about every week, we would have the brains, chop the head open. Mum used to cook the brains, make brain cakes. They were lovely.
Dad was a fox shooter, but I learned to shoot with an air rifle in the kitchen because he wanted me to be an expert rifle shot. And he'd put a target on the pantry door and I'd shoot it. And the pantry door had these little pin marks all over it.
Mary had a little lamb. Her father shot it dead. And now it goes to school with her between two chunks of bread.
Mummy, Mummy, what's that stuff? It looks like strawberry jam.
Tut, tut, my child. It's just Papa. Run over by a tram.
There's plenty of historical and anthropological evidence that fatherhood changes historically over time, from one culture to another, whether it's a culture in Africa where the dads were very, very involved right from the moment of birth on, through to the Victorian remote paterfamilias. I'm Kerrin Reiger from La Trobe University. My background is both as a historian and as a sociologist. There again, of course, we also know that within that shifting set of ideas about fatherhood, individual men then do carve out their own path. So it's not that in one historical period all men were like this or all men were like that. I had a very loving and devoted dad in the post-war 1950s, but I also know that the man next door was the typical stern, authoritarian sort of father whose kids used to have to, because they didn't have television and he didn't want to have television. When we got one, the kids had to post a lookout for when their dad came home from work over the hill so that they could scamper back over the back fence to not get into trouble. My dad was warm and loving and everything, but would also try on the "I'm the father of the household" sort of every so often, and then sometimes we just laugh at him as we got older.
Hush thee, my baby. Lie still with thy daddy. Thy mammy has gone to the mill to grind thee some wheat, to make thee some meat. Oh, my dear baby, lie still.
In the late 19th century, the father was still seen as the paterfamilias, the patriarch of the family, and that extended to, in a way, ownership rights over his household. Married women didn't have independent property rights. And those laws changed in the late 19th century, and progressively the role of the father was qualified in various ways. My name's Michael Gilding, Swinburne University of Technology. I'm a professor of sociology. There's certainly in the early 20th century prominent men and well-known men who were seriously concerned about changes in family structure. A lot of these anxieties that men were feeling in the wake of first wave feminism kind of crystallised around the role of men and the role of fathers and the control that men had over their household. The best exemplar of that is the 1904 New South Wales Royal Commission on the Decline of the Birth Rate, where basically I think there were two women who appeared before the Royal Commission, and there were a procession of men, leading religious figures, leading medical figures, leading politicians, and all of these men came before the Royal Commission and said how disturbed they were at the decline of the birth rate and how basically the cause was women's selfishness, and this had really serious implications for the family and for the nation.
My father is a very lovely man, but he had the saying that might is right. And so there was a very strong hierarchy in the family. He was in the army, and he ran us pretty much like an army camp in lots of ways. We all had jobs to do. When it came to the dishes, we had a roster situation. Susan would wash the first night, Robert would dry, Annette would put away. The next night, it would be Robert who would wash, Annette who would dry, Susan who would put away. And we always did it. We never not did what we were told.
Dad was never keen on us playing sport at the weekend. I tried out for football in grade 7, but at that stage it was too late because everyone had been playing since grade 3, and so I was always the reserve. When I was starting high school, the fellow down the back played hockey, and during the school holidays he talked me into having some hits with him. And so I played hockey for the first 3 years at high school, and then Dad decided it was time to get a Saturday morning job, so hockey died.
I'm Johnny Bell. I'm doing a thesis on fatherhood, and I'm from Monash University. I suppose I've always been interested in masculinities, in the idea of how men come to be as they are. And fatherhood seemed to me, and still seems to be, an important dimension of that. Unfortunately, there is a lot of consistency, a lot of what they call continuity. Breadwinning never really goes away. It remains the paradigm for a lot of fathers. And often there was a lot of anxiety, the idea that men were being phased out, which you can read from the 1920s and the 1930s. Concerns that the state is bankrolling the family. For the father, it was all about being able to go out and bring home a wage and then hand that wage over to his wife. He was seen to fail if he took any of that wage for himself. They very often frowned upon things like alcohol, not surprisingly, and gambling was never far away. These were the sorts of evils that they would pick fathers up on.
My mother kept leaving my father because he had a drinking problem. I found out before she died. By the time the third son was born, she'd left the father 7 times and then take him back and go back and try to work. We just laugh about it now. If he drank too much, we'd be sent off to look for him. We'd have to have a look at all the vacant blocks, any open doorways, gateways, anything he'd fall in. We'd find him and pick him up, get him walking. Where's me bottles? Don't you break those bottles.
Gates fly back and they're off and racing.
A little bit. My father was an inveterate gambler. He'd bet on anything. My mother used to grab whatever money she could from him, not remembering coming home from the races at one stage. In those days, they wore a vest with little pockets and a coat, and every pocket had banknotes in it. He'd had a big win at the races, and I remember him pulling them out and placing them on the kitchen table, Mum smoothing them out, little racks, £5, £10, so forth. She'd grab it into the bank. Now, this is eventually how they got a deposit for their house.
My father loved to punt,
And on most afternoons, we'd come home from school and he'd be calling up phone tab. This is 207-919-00, he'd say. This is 207-919-00, thank you. Race 5, Eagle Farm, number 6, 4 units each way. Race 6, Flemington, number 12, there's 2 units each way, thank you very much. His transistor covered in a brown leather case, frayed at the edges, and a lino floor in the kitchen, and he loved to punt my dad, and Jesus, he lost a lot.
There's always been some discussion about what a father should be. Fathers as a moral example to their children was certainly a popular one, but also the idea of father as disciplinarians, that they should provide that overarching authority in the family home. Child welfare inspectors encourage fathers to physically punish their children, to take a heavy hand in keeping them in line. Some part of that seemed to be a concern with unruly urban youth. There was a belief that the way to keep them in line, the way to make them useful and productive citizens, was to take that hard physical line.
I was frightened of him. Mum said to me that he had bloodied Teddy's nose. Teddy was playing up, and evidently Dan must have hit him on his nose. I was always a bit frightened because one of his sisters said that when he was a younger man, the women were chatter, chatter, talk, talk, talk. I remember them later on. They'd all try and get in. Dad got the table and just upended the table and the whole lot of them walked out. I was a bit apprehensive about Dad.
He was a train driver. Dad used to take us down the station or would walk down there and he'd sometimes sit us on his lap and he'd move the train about, you know, 2 feet up the track. I consider myself very fortunate. I have those lovely memories. I also remember him giving me a smack. And I remember him saying to me, "This is hurting me more than it's hurting you, Shelley."
Dad had a very high level of expectation of what we would be doing and what we wouldn't be doing and how we were going to do it. He would threaten with the belt, but to be honest, I can't remember ever really receiving the belt. But the threat was always enough. Mum's thing was, you know, wait till your father gets home, and then we would know very clearly what we had done was not acceptable.
My own research is from the case files of the Victorian Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. Case file inspectors would go through a family home and inspect the pantry, but also they would expect to see the ongoing presence of the mother. If the mother died or otherwise had left or was incapacitated, this seemed to create a situation that the children would be better off in an institution rather than in the care of their father. Very often men seem to find a workable strategy in order to care for their own children, and they were seemingly willing and determined to go on with that. And then all of a sudden they would hear a knock at the door and case file inspectors would tell them that, in fact, no, they're not doing a good job and that they'll never be able to do a suitable job. And they would try and convince fathers in the interwar years that really they should just give up their children to an institution.
Bye, baby bunting, daddy's gone a-hunting, gone to get a rabbit skin to wrap the baby bunting in.
Bye, I turned up on December 21st, 1944. Mum went back to work. Things were pretty tough after the war. When Mum and Dad worked, we had to look after ourselves. One time my brother was homesick. It was my job to borrow a bike and come home at 10 o'clock. Recess, see how he was, go back to school and come home at lunchtime and continue that for the rest of the day. Women didn't usually work. Mum did because she thought she was helping. She went to work to help Dad provide for us.
My wife never went to work. She stopped home and looked after the kids and she more or less run the house. Put it this way, I never interfered. If she told the kids a certain thing, it was it.
The idea of the breadwinner and the housewife It starts to emerge in the late 19th century in terms of government documents. So there's a whole variety of documentary sources which articulate appropriate roles for women and men, and these roles become more clearly defined from sort of the 1910s, 1920s onwards, and kind of reach a high point in the 1950s, where really the idea of the breadwinner and housewife is deeply institutionalised. It's institutionalised in laws, for example, around employment, Commonwealth public servants. Women are required to resign upon getting married.
After the enormous disruption of the war and then the enormous shifts in Australian society with suburbia expanding and new industries and new patterns of working life, etc., the family became much more a focus of debate and discussion. The ideas about fatherhood were very much part of this growing discourse about the quality of family life and conservative concerns about the deteriorating quality of family life, yet others sort of expressing hopes for a new, gentler, more egalitarian sort of family life.
Swing into spring with Holden, Australia's own car. See the luxurious Holden special.
A part of the tracking of fatherhood that I've done involved looking at women's magazines, primarily the Women's Weekly and the Woman's Day. The Women's Weekly in particular had a readership at one stage in the 1950s of over 1 million people. The father, as he appeared in the early 1950s, very often appeared in a chair, seated with the family positioned around him. He's not quite involved in the family. Whereas later on in the decade, he seems to be doing more, getting in the car with his family and driving somewhere. He's in the backyard. He's taking photos of the kids with a Kodak camera. It's a very limited interaction. It's under very particular terms. I would argue that this increased interaction was very much designed to complement his sense of masculinity, of who he was as a man. Anything that might threaten that, such as having to change a nappy or to actually parent on a more ongoing basis, played no part in these advertisements. That there was no such image of fatherhood at that time.
My father worked operating machinery. He was normally gone before we got up, so my mother would get up and make him breakfast and, of course, his lunch. She would make him usually a poached egg or two, and he would always leave us a little square or two of his egg on toast. You know, that's how I know what he had for breakfast, basically. So when we got up, there was usually three little squares of egg. That was a square for each of us.
We didn't have much money, but Dad would always, I suppose only once a year or once every 2 years, would come back with crayfish rolls for all of us, himself, Mum, and we five kids. Maybe they weren't expensive in those days, and they are now. And so my sister and I often talk about that. Remember those wonderful crayfish rolls? And now we question, how would Dad have been able to afford that?
Dad was a shift worker, and he was working sometimes three shifts.
He would be always on the train, commuting a lot. And he didn't do a lot with us. Even the annual holiday, often he would be working.
He had an active life, and I was always at home with the baby, and I wasn't happy with that idea. We had a family car, but my husband took that to work, and we hardly ever saw him. It used to be an irritation that he wouldn't help. I remember once I was completely exhausted. I think I had five children by that time. And he said, well, you need a holiday. So he sent me to Melbourne. It was winter time, and he holed up in the lounge room with the children. He put the TV on and he laid on the floor, and they ate whatever they felt like eating and threw the skins all over the floor, and then they'd read newspapers and they'd be all over the floor. And then the lounge room, by the time I got back from Melbourne, was knee-deep in chaos, nappies and newspapers and orange peeling and dirty plates. And he said, look how much we need you, Mother. That was 1960. 61. I'm a boy, I'm a boy, but not what I want to be. I'm a boy, I'm a boy, I'm a boy. I'm a boy, I'm a boy, I'm a boy, I'm a boy. I'm a boy, I'm a boy. I'm a boy.
The 1950s, it's a brief moment in time, but it was a kind of a moment where, in many ways, the roles of men and women were institutionalised in a very full way, in a very clear way, and in a very consistent way. And almost as soon as it happened, it started breaking up again.
We were living in one room with Anthony when I became pregnant the second time. I didn't want sex with Les, I really didn't, but I didn't have any say in it. The wife was chattel in the 50s. The husband could beat you up and the police couldn't do much about it. From my perspective, just horrible. And when I got into work, that was good therapy, I think.
I know when I stopped work to have my children, I hated that period, not being a mum, of course, but not actually bringing in money. I know I went without quite a bit. My husband wouldn't agree, but went without quite a bit because I wouldn't ask for money. I just felt that was not what I wanted to do. So when I had little kids and stopped the formal work, I did house cleaning and ironing for people, child minding, jobs like that, just to feel I was contributing.
Oh, just miles and miles of women.
One struggle, one fight. Women of the world unite.
Probably most men from the 1970s have had to think about masculinity in a way that they didn't have to before. In the wake of feminism and the gay movement, massive rethinking about masculinity and fatherhood. There were changes in the workforce and the demand for women's labour, which meant that married women went into the workforce. There were changes in technology, most notably birth control technology. All these things together resulted in the roles of breadwinner and housewife being questioned really profoundly.
The women's movement from the late 60s, but particularly through the 70s, started to have a broader sort of impact. You know, women's lib gave a voice to many women, particularly those in abusive relationships, but the sort of shifts in expectations sort of had a ripple effect. And then through the union movement and some of the women's groups within the unions and so on, you know, had a broader impact. But it wasn't so much that men's lives and that were the focus of attention, but of course you can't do one without the other.
I became a father in 1972. I suppose I stumbled into fatherhood. It wasn't something that I went out kind of thinking, I want to be a dad, I want to be a new dad. It was one of those things that you kind of expected would happen, but you hadn't put a lot of thought to it. For me, one of the best things that I ever did was I was at home when we brought our first child home. And I suppose one of the most revealing things to me was that Susan, my wife, didn't know much more about it than I did. And basically, in the end, we kind of worked through that together. And I suppose it was that point that I started to challenge this whole idea that men aren't competent caregivers and the idea that women have all the knowledge and competence in this area. I was a PhD student, didn't have a lot of opportunity to earn money. My wife was employed as a school teacher. She went back to work and I looked after our first child for half the day. My name is Graham Russell. I've spent, well, the majority of my academic career at Macquarie University, where I studied primarily families, fathers. Fatherhood hasn't been of much interest to history. It was of more interest to sociology from the 1970s. People like Graham Russell, who began to take a keener interest, thinking more about what fathers should be.
The time that I started research, it was still the case that the research field was totally dominated by studies on mothers. You know, like if you take the whole concept of bonding and attachment, they were very, very strong in that period of time. And, you know, maternal infant bonding was one of those things. If you got in the way of that, then it was going to create real problems for children. I was lucky in the sense, when I first started my research, there was also an emergence of research that came out of the United States. And one of the most powerful findings that came out of that was that infants can be attached to their dads as well as their mums. But it was more to demonstrate that, you know, there are other options in life in terms of the way that we organise families and the way that children can be brought up, and this can involve men.
My daddy gives me hugs. My daddy
A royal commission into male and female relationships is to be set up by the federal government. Cabinet has already approved the terms of reference and the membership of the commission. And Deveson, well-known Sydney journalist
and broadcaster. Which I think is good, because I don't think you can confine human relationships into little boxes, because one area of need spills over into another. But I think mainly the kind of pressures that affect family life and parenthood.
In the 1970s, I've looked primarily at the Royal Commission on Human Relationships, and I've looked at a great range of submissions from people talking about how family life should now be arranged, men and women. They're saying that men need to reform themselves. There's quite often an impression that Australian men in particular had been rather woeful in their interactions with their family, that they were seemingly unsuited to the demands of family life, that they were barely more than overgrown children, and that they needed to mature themselves. They needed to reform their approach to women and to children. They needed to be there more.
Royal Commission on Human Relationships, submission number 190.
26th of February 1975. To the Medical Superintendent, Parramatta District Hospital. Dear Sir, my wife is due to be confined at your maternity section in late March, early April. Though I'm given to understand that it is against hospital policy, I would like your permission to attend the birth of our child.
1967, Kate was born. When it took Faye, when she had contractions and so forth, the doctor told me to go home because I was just a nuisance. Those days, you weren't present. Very few men were present when their child was born.
My wife is in full agreement with the above proposal. Yours faithfully, J.D. Lewis.
The Parramatta Hospital, 25th of March, 1975. Dear Sir, I refer to your letter and the request contained therein for you to be in attendance at the birth of your child. This letter was received and considered at a meeting of the Board of Directors held recently, and it was resolved that the former policy of the hospital be changed to allow husbands to attend the births of their babies, subject to certain conditions. 1. The hospital must receive a letter from the attending doctor indicating their desire that the husband be present.
First few appointments Mary had with the doctor in Horsham, he looked across at me and he said, "You'll be there too, won't you?" And I said, "Oh, yes, doctor." And he said, "No, yes, doctor, you will be there."
2. Clean attire and footwear must be worn.
Quite an amazing sort of process to be part of, and just awe-inspiring, I guess, to see the birth of your first sort of child.
3. The husband must be prepared to wear full cooperation. 5. Must sign an undertaking to abide.
Welcome to the Francis Perry House Survivor's Time classes. My name is Timothy O'Leary, and the aim of the class is that you end up feeling really clear and confident about your role during the birth, but then after the birth, more broadly as a father.
There was a bit of a move also in those days towards childbirth education and the breathing. I'd forget the terminology of it now, but, you know, all of that kind of natural birth process. We went to a movie, saw a movie. movie was called Helga. It was about natural childbirth and, you know, men being involved and so on. And then that would have been one evening. But after that, it was more, we were working from a book. I forget the name of the book now, but it was more, you know, natural childbirth and getting support from other people who might have done it as well, just at an informal level.
Yes. I'm Peter. We're 30 weeks today.
My name's Adam. We are 33 weeks.
Yeah.
All good.
My wife's 23 weeks pregnant. OB appointment yesterday. She measured at 33 weeks. We have twins.
Okay.
In terms of the growing expectation by the 70s that men should be there for birth and not just down the pub or sitting, pacing up and down outside in the front of the hospital. It was led primarily by the emerging childbirth reform groups. They needed somebody else with the woman to help fight off the power of the institution. And it was also very much a reflection of the emerging childbirth education movement and what was called psychoprophylaxis, which is a system of careful breathing in order to, you know, organise yourself and prepare for labour and be able to manage the contractions and so on. Your husband was the one who was home practising all of this with you beforehand, and you needed him there. And certainly some of the American systems, the Bradley movement, Bradley called him a coach. He was a labour coach. Many doctors particularly were very ambivalent about men being involved in birth. But mostly they saw the advantages of it as time went on.
So she wants to have a natural birth, and she wants to experience that and all that comes with it, which is fine.
Pretty relaxed, well, just excited really.
The single most stunning change, the single most important behavioural change that's occurred since the 1970s, that the unambiguous empirical fact is that men are now present at the birth of their children, and that's a quite significant change, but it's also significant that it's the only significant change that you can really think of. You know, there are other changes too in terms of men's behaviour and in terms of their involvement with their children, in terms of their involvement with domestic work, but they're all a bit, you know, none of them are particularly compelling. They're all a bit vague and ambiguous and open to different interpretations. The one thing we can be sure of is that men are now at the birth of their children. It's a highly symbolic act, and that's fantastic that men are involved in that kind of way with their children as never before. But at the same time, it's a symbolic act which requires very little material investment in terms of labour time or cost or whatever. I mean, it doesn't involve men changing their lives in fundamental ways. So it's symbolic at every level of the word. It's symbolic in terms of making a gesture to a different role for men in relation to their wives and their children, but it's symbolic in the sense that it really is non-material. It doesn't require a big behavioural change.
I think some symbolic gestures are more important than others, and to dismiss it as, I suppose, just a mere symbolism, I think underestimates its importance. And certainly when you go back to the 1970s and you think that this really hadn't happened at all before, that it was a new gesture, it seems to encapsulate this sense at the time that there could in fact be a new sort of fatherhood.
This is AM. Good morning. I'm Red Harrison. The government's controversial sex discrimination bill passed through the House of Representatives last night, just 9 months after it was introduced. The bill outlaws discrimination on the grounds of sex, marital status or pregnancy, and it had a stormy passage through the Senate, where the opposition and the Democrats forced 53 amendments, and the opposition itself was divided at times, with the National Party warning it would have a bad effect on traditional family values.
It takes a while for families to really be impacted by those economic and political and those legislative attitudinal changes. And there's something really quite extraordinary, I think, that happens in Australian families in the 80s and 90s. That's the point by which women are aspiring to different roles. And either they're divorcing husbands, or they're saying, I want to work, or I want to go back to education, I want the kids in childcare, or I want to share raising children. Because it's kids and housework are the two big issues, kids in particular. I'm Alistair Thompson from Monash University. You begin to get, in the 1980s and 90s, within each family, negotiating the intricate, complicated, and intimate details of who does what and why and how we manage it. And it's unmapped territory.
Dad, girl, hello. I want to show you how these zombies fall. Except without the bounce.
That's crazy.
What, like this, Dad, like...
I was a very hands-on father, and working shift work really helped with that, because I could take the kids to school, I could pick them up, I would be a reading dad. I saw the purpose of getting married as having children, and made sure I chose someone that had that same interest. But I saw it as a joint thing of raising the kids. I was quite happy to babysit the kids and take them out and change the nappies and bath them and do all those different things with housework and things like that. And if that's where you're heading next, I'll dry the dishes. I can't cook to save my life. My wife's the one that does all the cooking, but we both work. My contact with my children is 10 times more than my father's was. Mine's much more hands-on and conversations with the kids. That would be the biggest difference. But between the tasks that my wife and I do and what my mum and dad did, I don't reckon there's a big difference, I don't think.
Family Guy!
Oh, yeah, well, what's the time? It's only 10 more minutes and then it's on.
Daddy, can you brush my teeth now?
Daddy! Earliest memories. Probably the earliest memory that jumps out is my childcare centre. I guess I must have been around about 3 or 4 years of age. A childcare centre attached to my mother's workplace. She, when both myself and my younger brother, he was born 3 years after me, with both of us, she went back to work fairly quickly. And maybe one of the reasons she was able to do that was the childcare that would have been provided there, I imagine, would have been quite subsidised for employees. She was working full-time, as was my father, sort of throughout that time.
The biggest single change in childcare hasn't been that men are playing a greater role in childcare. The biggest single change in childcare since the 1950s has been the growth of organised childcare and also the growth of informal care by people other than the mother. Grandparents, grandmothers in particular, family members. There are a lot more alternative sources of childcare. There were probably more in the past than we actually knew about anyway. But the really big change is the growth of organised childcare. That thing is unambiguous.
The overwhelming majority of childcare and child-related activities are done by mothers. But nevertheless, between 1974 and 2006, fathers have had a dramatic increase in the time that they allocate to their children. A trebling of this time on average. Fathers used to do about 11 minutes a day, and now they're doing about half an hour a day. My name is Michael Bittman. I'm an adjunct professor at the University of New England. For the last 25 years, I've been specialising in a particular type of survey, and this survey is called a time use survey. It seemed to me that in the 90s, I think it was mostly magazines, invented a new figure, the sensitive new age guy. And so they contracted that into the acronym SNAGS, who would be capable of complete role reversals in a very short period of time. And if you do qualitative research amongst late teen or early adult women about what they think their partnered life will be like, what their aspirations are, they all work on the assumption that there will be an equal sharing of domestic and child caring burdens. Now, I've been watching this statistics for about 15 years or so, and it's not growing spectacularly. You know, this is a tiny proportion. So that makes me think that actually the snag is a potentially a cultural idea.
With statistics, we know that men are at the birth of their children. In terms of domestic labour and childcare, there is no major behavioural change. It does seem that there is greater flexibility that men have in relation to some of the tasks in the home, but in terms of actually measuring overall contribution, the changes have been surprisingly slight.
But what about the emotional engagement, the quality of relationship or the kind of relationship that men have with their children now compared to the past?
Look, it's a really interesting question, and certainly there's a massive discourse around men's emotional relationship with their children now. There are lots of places you can hear language which talks about the quality of men's emotional relationship with their children. So the way we talk about men's relationship and fathers' relationship with their children has definitely changed. And perhaps it has changed too in fundamental ways. You know, perhaps it is less remote, perhaps it is less authoritarian than it used to be. I mean, generally though, we'd have to say that everybody's relationship with kids has changed. And the overall ethos with children nowadays is probably the permissive end.
As far as I can tell, since the 1920s, family size has been falling. You would have expected childcare time to go down, but it keeps going up. It turns out that what fathers like to do with children, I mean, they do this disproportionately compared to mothers, is play with their children.
A really strong feeling for us is that we both need to be there as much as we can, which means we're always, every night, reading a story to the kids. We do try to divide the responsibilities as evenly as we can, be that cooking or cleaning, washing clothes, looking after the kids. The reality has been that I continue to work full-time and Claire has taken time out from her work. For the first half of this year, I did actually reduce my days down to 4 days a week. But one of the practical difficulties as a father looking after young kids I've found is that there aren't many other dads out there who are doing the same thing. And so it's easy to feel quite isolated. Also, cutting down to 4 days, I was paid at 80% of the rate that I was before, but I still felt like I was doing the full week's work. When we looked around, trying to find well-paid part-time work, it's almost an oxymoron.
Children is definitely the point at which men and women's life courses completely diverge. In Australia, the most typical thing for women to do upon childbirth is withdraw from the labour force for a significant period. What happens to men is they actually increase their time in paid work. You can look at things like the take-up of family types of leave, you know, family leave to go to your child's speech day or cover for a sick child or something like that. Well, men typically don't take much of that either. When I did research on why don't men take up leave in a couple of firms which had award-winning human resources policies, you know, I discovered various things. First of all, the policy was one thing. How well anyone knew that policy, the knowledge of that policy was appallingly bad. Some relatively senior management were quite hostile to the idea of men taking this leave. I mean, I remember one subject telling me he understood why a young person would want to take time off work to travel overseas and experience how other countries did things, but he couldn't be sympathetic to someone who wanted time off just to look after their kid. You know, his view was they're not serious about their career.
There's really complex things going on as state policy and the broader discourse about what it is to be involved as a father are now having to be played out in the context of quite significant shifts in family constitution, remaking of families post-divorce.
Except that you gotta feed 'em, you gotta shoe 'em and clothe 'em, try not to loathe 'em, bug 'em and hug 'em.
Definitely not a straightforward narrative. You know, there's multiple threads and multiple players and often cross-cutting sorts of influences.
I feel positive that people, to some extent, have always negotiated responsibilities within the home. It's just their sense of what was possible or what was desirable influenced those negotiations, and they still do. I just think that the perspective of people as they enter those negotiations has changed. The spectrum of possibilities is a whole lot wider. My grandfather, who was a very blue-collar type of guy, he was a concreter. He's not someone you would peg as an involved father. And for the most of his fathering life, perhaps he wasn't. But in the 1950s, he was obliged to engage in a negotiation with his wife because they were both working. They were both required to work, but they worked at different hours. My grandmother worked at a vehicle components factory at night. It had to be understood that he would be at home. He would look after the children. He would cook their dinner. He would bathe them and he would put them to bed. And he had to be, to some extent, comfortable with performing that role. I think it must be the case that a lot of men, such as him, were more comfortable with those responsibilities than popular culture would have it.
When he calls me, you might call it sad, you might call me.
calls me dad. Yeah, he calls me dad.
I love you, Dad, Dad, Daddy. I love you, Daddy.
Hey, Dad, you do know the kettle just boiled?
Yes.
Where's my cup of tea?
Oh.